call the first case, 99-0743-CR and 99-1282-CR, et cetera. State v. Jesse Franklin and State v. Jeffrey Huck. We'll hear first from Richard Martin, Assistant State Public Defender representing Jesse Franklin and Jeffrey Huck. Mr. Martin.
Good morning. I am Richard Martin, and I do represent Mr. Huck, Mr. Franklin, and the defendants, appellant petitioners in these cases consolidated, both for briefing and for oral argument. These cases present the third and hopefully the final installment in this court's involvement with issues concerning the legislature's experiment with six-person juries in misdemeanor cases. In its darkest terms, the issue before this court is whether those least able to discern the constitutional infirmities in the statute should bear the price and the burden when others who were better situated, legislators who took an oath to uphold the Constitution, courts which take similar oaths, and attorneys which take oaths to defend their clients and assert their constitutional rights, when all those people in some way missed it, should an indigent defendant or even a non-indigent defendant have to pay that price and not have what our Constitution says is a jury trial?
Mr. Martin, that was a rather pointed comment, in as much as when I was one of the legislators who voted for the legislation. Are you suggesting that there's something inappropriate about my vote?
No, that's not my point. My point is that in any matter that comes before the legislature, reasonable minds can differ as to whether something is or isn't constitutional. That would happen in Chapter 980 and other matters which come before the courts, the juvenile jury.
Well, members of the legislature could have relied on the United States Supreme Court decision in the Florida case in which they recognized the constitutionality of a six-member jury.
Absolutely.
Members of the legislature could have read the 1853 Norville case and the premise of that case, which was not a criminal case, it was a civil case, was that you had to have a 12-member jury in all the time, even in civil cases. Well, we all know that's not true. When I was a district attorney, we had all kinds of cases involving six-member juries for drunk driving cases. Why would someone assume that that was unconstitutional?
I'm not saying someone should assume that it was. I'm saying that a reasonable person, reasonably informed about our Constitution, would recognize it was at least an open question until this court. I mean, I would contend, obviously, I would agree with the Hansford author and the rest of this court that Hansford was correct, and with all due respect, your dissent, and Huebner was not. But even having said that, reasonable minds can recognize that there's a legitimate issue. And that's my point, that a legislator, an attorney, a judge, these people are all trained to recognize the issue. When the legislature was involved with the juvenile jury trial with Chapter 980, it was known that there were constitutional implications to these policy decisions. And the courts, you know, ever since Murphy versus Madison, have been charged with making the final ruling, whether it is or isn't constitutional. I'm not saying that legislator couldn't vote in good faith for something believing it is constitutional, but another legislator could read the other cases and say, no, I, with all respect, I think you're wrong.
Well,
and that's what the
counsel couldn't be reasonably implied on the statute here. And that's what the testimony 75606 that it was constitutional. In other words, it had been around, as Justice Pratt or Pastor indicated, around for a while.
Absolutely am, Justice Wilcox, and in making that point, I think it's important to remember the heavy burden Mr. Hansford bore in front of this court to convince this court, beyond reasonable doubt, that that statute was unconstitutional. This court doesn't lightly strike down statutes. It doesn't happen frequently. And when it does, this court holds beyond a reasonable doubt the statute's unconstitutional. And six members of this court, from my reading of the case law, still believe that. And so I'm not saying a reasonable attorney has to challenge every legislative enactment, but when you have an enactment like this, which clearly, I'm sure the debate at the time at least recognized the constitutional potential. I don't have all the LRB research in front of me, but I'm sure there was at least a recognition that there's a constitutional question here, because there are cases around the country going different ways, and there's the body of case law that this court cited in Hansford to find it unconstitutional.
But this would have required any kind of prediction which way the court was going to go. So you're saying in order to be safe, rather than story later, that they should have raised it as a matter of predicting that this court was going to find the statute unconstitutional?
I'm saying absolutely to be safe. When a person's liberty is at stake and you've got a body of case law which says that this court has said shows that statute's unconstitutional, that to be safe you certainly raise it, especially when the issue is percolating through the courts in the first instance. This is not a statute that was on the books for 15 years, never challenged, and then some creative lawyer came up with a theory. This is a statute that was passed, and very quickly after its enactment was challenged, the Court of Appeals recognized the significance and certified it to this court. This court accepted the certification. It doesn't always accept certifications. This court recognized the significance, took the certification, and had oral argument and struck down the statute. And I think I use the analogy of a civil case. I don't know civil law much, but I use the analogy of if there was a change in the condemnation procedure that had constitutional implications. Would a reasonable lawyer sit on his reservations and risk his client losing potentially tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars in a condemnation proceeding because he's going to just presume the statute's constitutional and not raise a challenge and just, you know, hope that he can raise it later? That's what's really appalling here, is you have an attorney who knew of the challenge. This attorney in this record knew that this thing was being challenged, knew that there were other lawyers in Milwaukee, at least
one. Counsel, let me interrupt you. Are the facts of these two cases different that we can distinguish them? In one case, the lawyer said she knew that there was a problem, but didn't raise it because she didn't think it was waived, a constitutional, fundamental constitutional right would waive, if I remember the facts.
Sure.
That was not true in the other case, and I'm sorry, I can't remember which case, which at the
correct
moment. Which one was the one where the lawyer knew? Was that
Huck?
Huck, okay.
Huck, right.
And the other one, did the lawyer know?
I argue it's reasonable to assume that the lawyer did, but we don't have a mock the hearing record in the other
you
case.
Don't. And you do in
correct.
Okay.
Correct. The other one was denied without a hearing. It's interesting confluence of events here. There's a law firm, Cornwell, Real, and Yamahiro. Mr. Real was a trial attorney in the Wingo case that I argued last term. This reversed. This court reversed. Mr. Cornwell was the attorney for Mr. Franklin, where there was no Mater hearing. And Ms. Anderson, Michelle Anderson, was an associate in this firm. And so I argue in the brief that it's reasonable to assume, in fact, that there's evidence in the record, in the Huck record, that there was discussion within the law firm about this very issue. So I think that what happened in Mr. Franklin's case, and it's a very interesting procedural mess, because Mr. Franklin filed repeated pro se motions shortly after his own conviction, raising a six-person jury. He knew this issue was percolating in the courts. He filed these motions pro se, several of them, serial motions.
After the conviction?
Correct. Pro se, post-conviction motions, which the trial court erroneously denied as untimely, and I point this out in the brief, in the correspondence file, a Court of Appeals correspondence file, there are several orders granting Mr. Franklin extensions for his pro se motions. For whatever reason, the trial court in Mr. Franklin's case was unaware of those extensions and just deemed them untimely, deemed the motions untimely, and denied them. So there's never been any sort of hearing evidentiary proceedings in Mr. Franklin's case. And the other interesting thing in Mr. Franklin's case, I point out, is that he repeatedly importuned his attorney, Mr. Cornwell, to raise all sorts of other issues, some borderline frivolous issues. So he presented himself as a litigant who wanted to assert any conceivable claim that might exist under any law book he'd ever come across. So if he had known about this claim, it's a virtual certainty he would have tugged at his attorney and said, you know, there's a six-person jury question here. There's a constitutional problem here.
Mr. Martin, let's assume that you're right, that we've got deficient performance by counsel. How do you get around the requirement, the second prong? How are you able to show that there's a reasonable likelihood of a different result in these cases? Or in other words, how do you show that there's real prejudice?
That's the, sort of the penultimate question in these cases. I think Judge Schutzen very perceptively addressed that issue. I mean, he came down in a way I don't agree with, but he read this court's Heber decision to say that you have to look at prejudice in a purely Strickland versus Washington sense, whether the trial was fair or unfair, and if the result wouldn't have been different, no prejudice. However, he recognized that there's another way to look at it, and that is the prejudice was the defendant was not given a 12-person jury. And if you look at the prejudice that way, and in Hansford, this court said, a 12-person jury is an indispensable component of the jury trial right. If that's the case, then neither of these defendants ever had what this court said was a real jury. They've never had a jury trial. And that would, it's the same situation as the cases Lehman and Cooley and other cases where there's been a jury of less than 12, and there's been 11. You can't show that the result would have been different with 12 or 11, but it's fundamental. There's got to be 12 citizens in that box unless there's a proper waiver of that full number. So that's the prejudice. And I point out in the brief that there are several instances where both this court and the Court of Appeals has recognized that a Strickland versus Washington analysis, basically a trial fairness analysis, can't reach every situation. The most obvious is State versus Smith, plea bargain context. An attorney doesn't object to a breach by the state. And if it's a material substantial breach, this court said nevertheless, the remedy is a result, or is a remand for resentencing with specific performance of the plea bargain. Well, you can't show the judge would have imposed a different sentence, but you have the right to the performance.
Doesn't Strickland say that there's three areas where there will be a presumption of prejudice, and none of those three areas would seem to be touched by this particular case?
Well, I think Mr. Posner-Weber makes that argument as well. Specifically, one of the areas, as I recall, is where the court interferes with the attorney-client relationship. That's one of the ones. Another is the conflict of interest. But I think, you know, the courts, with all respect to the courts, aren't entirely blameless in this matter. I mean, there is...
Well, you know, we don't have to play past blame. The question is, was the Strickland list exclusive?
And I don't think it is. As I said, State versus Smith is not a Strickland-type case at all. State versus Ludwig, that this court decided about 16 years ago, is not a Strickland analysis at all. Mrs. Ludwig had a fair trial, was fairly found guilty, and was sentenced. Yet this court said her attorney didn't discharge his duty to convey a plea offer to her, didn't explain to her her right to accept or reject it, and this court ordered relief because her attorney failed in a fundamental duty.
Like, you may not like this, but aren't you really saying that the denial of the state constitutional right of 12-person jury is prejudicial per se?
That's
your position. You may not like the way I phrase it.
No, I understand what you're saying, because, yes, I am, but I recognize what happened in Huebner, where this court has rejected that position, and so I think that, but in Huebner, as I point out, I think also in the brief, this court was under the impression that Huebner had asserted an ineffective counsel claim in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals had rejected that, and then he decided not to reassert that in this court. In fact, no such claim was ever asserted in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals decision is just flat wrong. I've read the Huebner brief there in this court's records somewhere. No ineffective counsel claim was ever asserted in Huebner. And in fact, I vividly remember Ms. Day a year ago telling you that it's not fair to blame an attorney for this. I mean, the attorneys are busy. They're in court every day. They can't keep up the law. So she specifically said, I'm not raising ineffective counsel. And so this court didn't address the issue in the context of an ineffective counsel claim. And I think that it ties in a little bit to the whole issue, the whole concept of waiver and what this court in Huebner called a forfeiture of the right. One of the considerations is giving a trial court the opportunity to correct its own errors.
Counsel, I would like to follow up on the chief's question. The chief
questioned you, aren't you really just arguing what was advanced in Huebner, that the constitutional violation per se constitutes prejudice? I follow that with your very first comment in your argument that this presents the third and final installment. My question is, does Huebner, being a 3-1-3 decision, have any precedential value? Why shouldn't I just approach this case saying it makes no difference to me whether there is ineffective assistance of counsel? There was a constitutional violation that requires a reversal. What precedential value is there in the Huebner 3-1-3 case?
That presents a lots of knotty questions, both in terms of briefing and arguing this case for some fairly obvious reasons. First of all, if the dissenter in Huebner had not joined the opinion of the court, for instance, and just sat out and said, well, I was in the legislature, this is passed, and I'm not going to be involved in this.
You mean the concurring opinion?
The concurring opinion. If he had sat out and said, I'm not going to be involved, then you would have had a 3-3 split, and it would have been an affirmance, a clear affirmance of the Court of Appeals, which would have had some precedential force. Now, he has concurred in the result, and so I think arguably Huebner has precedential value.
As I understand the difference, essentially the lead opinion indicates that that even though there's a constitutional violation, and we said that in Hansford, that you received a fair trial and there's no reversal. As I read the concluding paragraph in the concurring opinion, it emphasizes the concurring opinion is all, there is no constitutional violation. So how can you even say that there was no fair trial? How can that even be an issue?
Right.
That's the way I read it. So to me, I think there's a strong argument that Huebner has no precedential value at all, and we're right back at Huebner here today. We don't even get to ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, I'd gladly embrace that if I thought it would get me somewhere in terms of arguing this case.
We admire candor, right?
I mean, that presents a problem.
Truth and honesty.
That's a problem that both Mr. Pilsner Weber and I have in approaching the briefing and the argument of this case. We've got two clear camps in on the Huebner issue, and we've got a clear dissent that feels very strongly that this court had it absolutely wrong in Hansford. I'm sorry.
It seems like a dissent to me. I know.
It seems like a dissent to me. It's logic, the reasoning is so different from the others that it...
The camp will take Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry?
I said that camp would take Justice Prosser. Go ahead.
I think if you look at what the narrowest opinion of the court is, I think you have to say that the Huebner decision, the narrowest opinion was Mr. Huebner had a fair trial with two or six people, and that's why I have to sort of acquiesce in that it has some precedential force. However, I do think you are confronting the issue again, perhaps. Right? The other point I wanted to make, and I thought about this...
Well, there's no question, I don't think, that he had a fair trial. If by fair trial you mean six people, fair and true, decided the case on the basis of good evidence presented for them. The question is whether or not he had a trial according to the state constitution. Deserves to be upheld. Right?
That's right. I mean, you can make the
same... That's your argument.
Right, you can make the same claim where there was a failure to have a proper waiver of a jury trial whatsoever, and defendant had a fair bench trial. And you could say, well, he had a fair trial. This judge, for instance, as a judge in Damascus, was very fair and patient and did a great job of the trial, so he had a fair trial. But that's not the question. The question is, did he have a jury trial? And that's where, I can't help but, take issue with the lead opinion in Huebner, because Huebner says there's nothing in Hansford that says a six-person jury isn't basically fair. Well, it's harder for me to reconcile with Hansford that says it's an indispensable component of a jury under our Constitution. I don't think those things can be reconciled. I think that the Chief Justice's dissent in Huebner, you know, does hit the nail on the head. You can't reconcile those two things. But another point I wanted to make, specifically with reference to Justice Prosser's position in this, is I don't think that one necessarily has to assume that even if you think Hansford is wrongly decided, that automatically means you vote to affirm here. A judge can believe that Miranda was made up of a whole cloth, but judges have to apply Miranda. They have to hold Miranda Goodchild hearings, and they have to make rulings and findings. You know, you can think that Mapp versus Ohio is a bad idea, but our U.S. Supreme Court has engrafted that into the body of the common law. And so I think even Justice Prosser, who may not like the result or the reasoning or the history in Hansford, is bound by Hansford unless he can convince other members of this court to join him. And so I think even his vote should be, in a sense, not fixed based on the history of these cases.
Well, the dissent has made a good try here, and I recognize that to the position of justice in one place or the other. But I think basically my question as far as prejudice, if you disagree, you'd agree that there was no prejudice, but what you're saying is that because of Hansford, because the words indispensable are so clear that it's automatic. That's what you're.
But I say that is prejudice. I say if you don't have a jury, jury trials are kind of a fundamental thing that even kids in school know about, jury trials. And if you read Hansford the way I read it, it says a jury is 12 people.
Right.
And neither of these defendants had a jury within the meaning of Hansford. Both of these defendants are serving sentences, one in the double digits and one in the high single digits. These are people who are serving more time than people who steal cars and get 2 years in prison. And they get 12 jurors. They get a real jury. So that's my problem. I think Judge Schutzen was correct. It depends on how you define prejudice. And I define prejudice as these people didn't have jury trials, period. And that's what I think Hansford stands for.
How many people are there out there in this judicial?
Fewer and fewer, I'm sure. The last time I was here, I did call this court's office to see how many cases were pending, and then it was just a large handful. And I'm sure, and that's the other point I wanted to make, the floodgates concern that I think motivated this court somewhat in Huebner, I think is less and less of a concern, partly for some of the reasons I mentioned in Winko a year ago. To get into court, you have to be in custody. If you serve a 15-day sentence for disorderly conduct or 3 months for battery, you're out of custody. There's no easy way to get into court. So the only cases left are either a few who may have gotten stays of their sentence and are still pending what this court does in Chapter 3, or people like Mr. Huck and Mr. Franklin, who are serving long sentences in prison. Mr. Franklin serving prison sentences by virtue of the repeater, the habitual criminality statute.
What about people who've been convicted of operating under the influence under a six-member jury? Wouldn't they have a motive to come back and attack that?
I'm not sure how they could attack the criminal conviction without being in custody. There may be. I'm not familiar with all the ins and outs of the traffic code and ways you might be able to attack judgments, but I think, and that gets into this court's decision that they clarified, and the name is escaping me. Yes. Gets into Hahn and what avenues there are, but with all respect, I understand the floodgates concern. But I think that Hansford is such an important decision, and this court has not overruled Hansford, that its integrity is compromised by letting floodgates just undercut that, especially when floodgates is a trickle now. I don't think floodgates is a big problem at all. I, if I'm wrong, I'm sure I'll be corrected later, but I don't think that's a big concern. I just would encourage this court. In Ludwig, this court talked about the special dependence a defendant places on his or her attorney. And in Harper, this court talked about the need for an attorney appointed to represent an indigent defendant to give the same representation, the same quality that he or she would give to someone who privately retained him. This court sets the bar and sets the standard. And if we're going to condone lawyers basically sitting on their client's rights in areas where the issues are live and unsettled and important, I don't think that sends the right message to the bar or to the public.
But the message you're trying to send, and I just counsel, is that attorneys should always be creative and aggressive, which is not a bad message, but you're saying they also should guess, and they should predict, and they should, and if they don't, then they can be held to be deficient in their performance. And that seems to be a rather high bar that you're asking, because it's not only in this area, it's in all the areas that this court, you know, deals in, and knowing what's going on both nationally and in this state, it doesn't seem to be a position that would be, it's a rather high, excuse me, a rather high expectation. Nothing wrong with that, but that's where you want to set the bar.
Well, I guess I would quibble with the guessing and the predicting, because I think that I'm talking about an issue which, as I said, the constitutionality of this issue was reasonably well known and clearly known by this attorney here. But I would also argue that on another level, that's what lawyers do every day. You can't file a pleading if you haven't made a reasonable investigation of the facts and the law. You can get in trouble if you don't. You can't assert a defense if you haven't made a reasonable investigation.
If you miss the law, that's different than if you miss how a court is going to may decide a case 1 or 2 years down.
But this is an issue that, you know, if Hanser is correct, and I fervently believe that it is, and the state hasn't taken up the implicit invitation to challenge it, if Hanser is correct, it was clear. The duty, the law was clear. The cases go back decades and decades. The constitutional conventions were there. This was a unanimous decision. And it was a very forceful decision. I see my time is up.
Right, counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Assistant Attorney General Gregory Posner-Weber, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. The ghosts of Sharon Rooley and Suzanne Hakopian are here today now. The state asks this court to hold that in both appeals, trial counsel's failure to make a state constitutional objection to use of a six-person jury trial does not constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. We ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision in these consolidated cases.
What standard are you using for ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think the only standard that we can use in this litigation is Strickland versus Washington. Neither of the defendants have briefed or argued that there's a different standard under the state constitution. And I think it's important that we agree on the analytical framework that these cases have to be decided in.
Okay, so tell us what the standard is.
Deficient performance and prejudice, both established by the petitioners.
What does deficient performance mean?
Performance that falls outside prevailing professional norms. Prejudice, under Strickland, involves an outcome or a decision that is not reliable. If the defendant received a fundamentally fair trial, a trial whose outcome is reliable, then he has received effective assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment and under Strickland. And I perceive this as being a key point, particularly because of the questions that the bench asked. I don't think that this case can be removed from the analytical framework of Strickland. I don't think that this case can, or these cases rather, can be resolved by looking to Huebner, whether you construe the lead opinion as the majority of the court or the dissenters as the majority of the court. The fact that there may have been a constitutional violation here in the eyes of three justices of the court evaluating the case in Huebner, or using that Huebner framework, doesn't entitle Franklin and Huck to relief in this litigation.
Let's just look at deficient performance. I don't think it matters as to deficient performance when you look back at that time as to whether the court here ultimately holds that it's a six-person or 12-person jury. Doesn't matter.
To the performance standard.
To the performance standard.
Well, that runs to prejudice, I think.
Yeah. Because
if the council at that time knew this was a, quote, hot legal issue, council didn't have to guess which way it was going to come out. Council's obligation was to preserve it. Do you agree with that? I mean, that I've got a big if there. I've got a big if.
And Chief, I do too. My concern...
Let's suppose council knew it. Suppose there were billboards all over the state that said, watch out. Suppose it was pasted on every computer. Yeah, I'm exaggerating. Let's just assume every council knew this was a hot issue. So now council's in court, knows it's a hot issue, knows it is pending or will soon be pending, okay? Now, deficient performance is not going to depend on how the court ultimately rules. Is that right?
No, it's not going to depend on how the court ultimately rules. But the question, I think, and it was one that was touched on a few years ago by the Court of Appeals in McMahon, the question is what obligation does a defense attorney have to forward an argument or to put forward an argument in an area that could best be described as murky?
Murky in result, but not murky that it's a good issue. As counsel talk about good, potentially good issue. That's why I'm trying to debate this with you,
sure,
to figure out what your position is on the issue as I've set it forth, then you should change it. If it's not, my
bottom line concern is this, Chief. If we obligate criminal defense attorneys to be aware of pending cases at some level and to incorporate that pending litigation, the appellate litigation, into a trial situation, into a trial case, I think we open the door to establishing a performance standard that may be nigh unto impossible to meet. I mean, we're talking about certifications here, and I was thinking about this as I was walking over to the court. We're talking about certifications, a relatively small pool of possible cases, a handful in the cases that are decided each year by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. Where do we draw the line? Do we require a defense attorney to be aware of possible appeals in three-judge cases in the Court of Appeals that may or may not be relevant to the issue in the trial court?
Well, that's why I'm questioning you. You know, in this court, lawyers can, we do have issues set forth. It's right on the internet. You can set forth in the Wisconsin opinions. They're all over the place. Doesn't mean it's easy to find. Doesn't mean I remember them. Oh, I voted to take them. I don't, is the truth of the matter. But you can look at them. At any one time, there are 3,600 cases pending in the Court of Appeals, roughly, give or take. They don't have an issue statement. That is, they don't have someplace that you can figure out what the 3,500 cases are.
And even we can't do that. I mean, I assume Mr. Martin and I both work in offices that...
Right, well, you might keep track.
And I have no idea what's pending on the civil docket.
Do you know what's pending on the criminal docket? And if so, would you tell the Court of Appeals, maybe we can use your system?
No.
We have talked about this. The Court of Appeals and I have talked about this. But we have to figure out a system for doing it.
Appellate attorneys, I think by nature, are voracious readers, and on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being absolutely no knowledge of what's pending in the appellate courts, and 10 being certainty, with the pool of cases that I'm responsible for in appellate litigation, I'd put my knowledge at a 3 or a 4.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
And I read voraciously. A criminal defense attorney, who is in trial litigating a matter may not be aware of the fact that, say, in the Court of Appeals, there is a decision or a case pending where both parties have asked for publication, one where there might be a reasonable expectation that it'll be published. A few years ago, the Court of Appeals in a civil case, Cook against Cook, came down with a ruling that was very important to criminal practice, that the Court of Appeals has no power to overrule itself. We cite that case regularly. I had no idea that thing was pending.
What does it say?
Now I know that it says that the Court of Appeals lacks the authority to overrule its own precedent.
Isn't this issue, though, a little different from the run-of-the-mill garden variety unsettled issue of constitutional criminal procedure? And this is a radical change in the criminal law, the six-person jury trial in misdemeanor cases, right? Always used to do it with 12. The law was changed. Now we do it with 6. I mean, it's sort of sui generis in terms of how you analyze it, therefore, isn't it?
But then you look, I think, you look at a point that Justice Wilcox raised in questioning. You have a statute, a legislative directive that's presumed to be constitutional, even in the face of a certification. There is no guarantee, and I'm sure Mr. Martin will correct me, but I think in one of the cases, the trial was actually held before the certification was granted. There's no guarantee that this court will accept a cert. There is no guarantee how the case will resolve. Presumptions being that the statutes generally are found to be constitutional. And again, if I can bring it back to the analytical framework of Strickland, Strickland doesn't require prescience on the part of criminal defense attorneys. It doesn't require a perfect defense. It doesn't even require the best defense under the circumstances.
Well, that goes to predicting the outcome of the constitutional challenge, not the issue that the chief was raising a moment ago, which is just preserve it. We're talking about waiver forfeiture here of a fundamental constitutional right.
If the criminal defense attorney, and I, points are popping up, I don't know that we can, first of all, there are two different factual situations in the cases, Franklin and Huck. We don't know, I believe, in Franklin, what the knowledge of trial counsel was as to the certification. I know Mr. Martin believes that because these attorneys were all from the same firm, we can infer certain things. There's no Mockner hearing. There's no record on trial counsel's understanding in Franklin. In Huck, trial counsel understood that there was a certification pending and also understood that at least one attorney in Milwaukee County was filing pleadings to challenge the six-person jury. In hindsight, should that attorney have filed a motion challenging the constitutionality of the six-person jury? Probably. Probably. Was that attorney constitutionally required under the Sixth Amendment to do it? I don't think so.
Counsel, some of the questions and inquiry have been dealing with the floodgates and can we call this deficient performance and what are the ramifications of other cases pending and blah, blah, blah. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that in terms of the impact of a decision following Justice Sykes' comments, that this is a forfeiture of a fundamental right which requires reversal, I'm adding, that approach has the impact of a trickle as opposed to a floodgate?
My concern about the floodgate is more how this will play out in evaluating cases of ineffective assistance of counsel and non-six-person.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, because you've got the issues of, well, are trial counsel going to be held to a standard to know what's pending in the Court of Appeals, the 3,500, you know, I don't know how many criminal cases, and then does it make a difference if that's they're going to be held to know that this is the kind of case that's probably going to be published or not published, ergo precedential value, and blah, 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 blah. So I understand the argument and concerns about floodgates, and that's why I ask. And I ask it seriously, the difference between the floodgate and the trickle and the consequences of how this case may be approached. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that if it's approached in the other vein, as I have just advanced, that the impact is a trickle in terms of the number of affected?
In terms of the number of misdemeanants who are currently in a position to still challenge their convictions, raw numbers of misdemeanors, I probably agree with Richard, with Mr. Martin. I think it's a relatively small number. I've got to mull over the possibility of how OWI convictions might factor into this. In terms of the misdemeanors, yeah, it's a small number, but this court's decision will not. If this court finds that counsel in this case was deficient because he or she...
I'm not talking about deficiency. That's not going the ineffective assistance of counsel route. That is rather going the route that this is a forfeiture of a fundamental right without waiver of that right, which requires reversal.
Then I have to come back to my key point, which is that I don't want to move outside of the analytical framework of Strickland here. And I understand why the defendants want to do that, because if we treat this as a Strickland case, they lose. They lose because they received a fundamentally fair trial. So you have to move outside of Strickland in order for these appellants to get relief.
Which is what the dissent in Heber did. And what the fundamental argument here is this. Even if counsel consents to an 11-person jury, the court said no, right? The court said no. Why? Because you have a state constitutional right to 12-person, which the defendant did not waive.
And in this case, no waivers.
Okay. And then the 11-person case, right? Remember that jury case? Cooley. The court said, nevertheless, that is not a good result. That is, we will not accept that. You have to have a new trial. Because right to jury in this state is 12-person, period. We didn't go to Strickland. And in Wingo, we did not go to Strickland. We said, no, you didn't have 12 person, you're out. That is the conviction, or I think they were.
Wingo was an aberration.
Well, of course, they're all aberrations and you don't like them.
My good friend, Mr. Martin, and I will agree that that was an aberration.
An apparition or an aberration? Which
both. Sharon really is sitting here with me, even as we speak.
I mean, that's really the issue here. That was the issue in Huebner, too. 331, right? Do you go Strickland?
Well, no, because Huebner wasn't an ineffective assistance.
I understand that, but when you go to the guts of the Huebner argument, that's what the argument is. Do you look at treating this as...
I don't want the Chief Justice.
Do you look at this as sui generis? And that's what the dissent did, which I understand you would...
In Huebner, there was no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
I understand that.
And unless this court, and I think...
But it's presented to you by Justice Bradley. She presents it without looking at ineffective assistance of counsel. She is looking at it as per se. And you're saying that the denial of the state constitutional right of 12 persons is per se not permitted here.
I certainly think that that's the position of three of the members of this court.
That's all I'm trying to agree with.
Sure. There are three members of the court in Huebner who I think, based on the decision in Huebner, probably would end the discussion at the point where Mr. Martin ends it. There was no trial by a jury of 12 here, end of discussion. The state's position in this case is that you can't look at it that way. It has to be the analytical framework of Strickland. Unless this court, and Lundstein gets up here and says that Ramos is the key case in his career, this may well be the key case in mine. Because the more that I think about this, the more that I think that real damage can be done if this court moves out of that Strickland framework, analytical framework. No one in this case, neither side, has suggested that the state constitution, insofar as Sixth Amendment or state claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. No one suggested that the standard is different under the Wisconsin Constitution here. If this court finds reversible error per se, it seems to me that what they are saying is that under the state constitution, there's a different standard for ineffective assistance when issues relate to jury size. And nobody's briefed that. And I have never seen anything in Quaife to suggest in the constitutional histories of Wisconsin to suggest that claims of ineffective assistance would be resolved in a different way.
How do you explain Zakuli and
Wingo? In what regard?
Well, compared to this. In Wingo, the conviction was reversed when the defendant was tried under six-person, even though the defendant didn't object. In Wingo is the present case. No statute was in existence. Remember that? No statute
right,
was in existence.
Right. Wingo was the aberration. It shouldn't have been.
Well, but what you had in Wingo was a perfectly fair trial with six people, right? And no one objected.
And no claim of ineffective, no analytical
claim. That's right. That's right. But there was no statute authorizing. The court said that six people are not a jury. We did not have an effective assistance of counsel. We know they said no, six is not a jury in the state. Per se, prejudicial out.
Not in. I'm coming back to home. Not in the analytical framework of Strickland.
You talk about from the state's point of view, damaging ramifications. From the state's point of view, are there more ramifications by going out of the Strickland approach and during the per se approach the chief just mentioned? Or is there more ramification of staying in the Strickland approach and saying the attorney's performance was deficient? Which has the greater?
Excellent question. There's certainly room for mischief if this court sets about the task of defining performance standards relating to what a reasonable attorney should or shouldn't know about cases that are before the Court of Appeals or this court on cert or the U.S. Supreme Court, for that matter. In the context of Strickland, we have a, if you will, fallback argument in terms of prejudice. We can look at what the actual effect of the error was. And still save an otherwise vulnerable conviction because it was a no harm, no foul situation. The defendant received a fair trial. In the framework that you're suggesting, where you have prejudicial error per se, it seems to me that you will have a situation where a defendant would receive an otherwise fundamentally fair trial, a trial where there were no other claims of error but for the jury size. And lose otherwise valid convictions. Now, three members of this court, because they have concluded that there is this fundamental jury trial right and a jury equals 12, three members of this court, in the context of Huebner, have decided that that's a result that they can live with. I personally cannot, because as we argue on brief, the distinction in quality of fact-finding between six-person juries and 12-person juries in the criminal context is minuscule. It's minuscule. That's why the defense wants to move this out of the Strickland analytical framework, because they can't show prejudice.
Depends on how you define prejudice. If you define prejudice as the verdict, that might bring you one result. If you define prejudice as you don't end up with the number of jurors you're entitled to under the Constitution, you end up with another.
But this court in Pitch and all of the post-Strickland cases and the U.S. Supreme Court in Strickland have told us what prejudice is. They've defined the terms. The defendants in this case cast the mold. They raised claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. By doing that, they chose the analytical framework that this court would follow. And now they want to change the definition of prejudice under Strickland. They want to offer a different definition. And I don't see a basis in the law to do that. As always, I prefer to answer questions.
Well, this concept of prejudice is described by Justice Bradley of two kinds of prejudices, one that the court faces in a number of different situations, civil and criminal, and that sometimes you can't show the outcome would be different. And sometimes you can't show reliability. And you get that where the judge tries a case, for example, and the defendant didn't personally waive jury trial. Do you have a fair trial? Sure. Do you have a trial whose outcome is reliable? Sure. Do you have a trial that fits the state constitutional standards? No. Do you therefore affirm every conviction where a judge didn't get a personal waiver? The court has said no. What says you got to retry it, right?
Not, I believe, in the context of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
I know you keep coming back to that.
Well, I believe, because that's the polemic that we're working within today.
Well, it's a polemic if you accept the state. If you accept... What if you had an argument in that kind of case where it's instead of what the absolute rights are, but it comes up under ineffective assistance of counsel? So if you have two cases side by side, one, the defendant argues ineffective assistance of counsel, this is the judge jury, and the other one argues, doesn't make that argument, do you have two different results in
yes.
that case?
Yes, yes. I mean, the state in... The state in Nicholson, I think, at 148 was second. We basically came out and said, had the defendant made a particular motion in a timely fashion, he would have won. It was a perfectly meritorious motion. The fact that it was now raised in a collateral proceeding where he was foreclosed from making the argument because it was procedural rather than...
I accept that.
This court's most recent pronouncements on prejudice in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel cases was the Erickson decision, where in a lengthy argument, in a lengthy analysis, this court basically said, even though it is hard, and in the court's words, very difficult to prove prejudice you must prove if you're going to get relief under Strickland, and if your case doesn't fall within one of the three categories of cases, and we cite them in our brief, one of the three categories of cases in which prejudice will be presumed. Not all errors are prejudicial. Not all errors require reversal.
So why don't we just add this as a fourth category? Stay with your Strickland. Just add this as a fourth category.
There's no U.S. Supreme Court precedent to support it.
Well, there will be.
No independent state.
There will be. We just have to wait for the case to come up. We got to act now.
If this court does that, again, I think they do violence to the analytical framework.
That's never been the impediment.
Summarize waiver constitution. Isn't that an issue here? Am I missing something? Isn't there a second issue? That's
God, I hope not.
Do you want to talk about Ramos if you've got a few more?
I was going to raise it, but I was late.
I had the best time watching those oral arguments yesterday. I apologize to the court if my laughter offended, but
the end of the term.
It is the end of the
term. We're almost at the last case, counsel.
I would have agreed. I would have given an arm and a leg if Judge Lunston had been here to hear that. I thank him for it.
Thank you, Mr. Posner Weber. Mr. Margin, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Justice Sykes made an interesting point, and it helps crystallize for me why this is different. Before I go to the point, I just want to say this. The issue isn't an attorney's duty to be up on the certifications. An attorney's duty to know what three-judge panel cases have been ordered, and what's recommended for publication, what's been ordered published. That's not the issue. The issue is the attorney's duty to know the Wisconsin Constitution. And that's where Justice Sykes' point comes in quite clearly, because this was a radical change. It was a departure from decades of practice, and clearly it raised a constitutional question. The best way to think about this is, during the transition period, on the 6th floor of the Milwaukee County Courthouse, you had 6 and 12-person juries being impaneled on the same day, because some of the offenses took place before the effective date of the statute. Others took place after the effective date of the statute. You could have the same judge picking a jury back-to-back, 6-12, 6-12, all week. And
counsel,
it didn't...
I'm not a lawyer with Milwaukee County, but this was a common... I understood it, and I may be wrong, but Justice Sykes correct me. There was one judge or two in out of the total of 46 judges.
No, that's not my... You misunderstand. My point isn't that some judges were giving 12 and some were giving 6. No, that's not my point. My point is that some judges still had to give 12 in cases that predated the effective date of the statute. And so that for a period of weeks and months, you could walk up and down the hall and see 12, 6, 12, 6 if you were looking. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to think, well, something, there's a change here. And, you know, since it's the last day of the term, I want to say something I've said to my wife every 6 weeks. I hope doctors are better regulated than lawyers. This is scary to me that we can say that a lawyer doesn't have some fundamental duty to be conversant with the Wisconsin Constitution. And the case law, which this court recited so painstakingly in Hansford, was not hard to find. Some of it is right in the annotations.
You're talking about predictability. And even when you had a, you knew the Wisconsin Constitution letter by letter, what difference would it have made? Because you're talking about what 7 people on the Supreme Court might have done with a particular case.
I might surprise you by saying this, but I don't think the result in Hansford was foreordained, and it certainly wasn't foreordained it would be unanimous, and yet I still think if I had been a trial lawyer, I would have raised the objection, because the potential was there, the constitutional claim was there, it was in the text and the history of our Constitution, so the issue isn't whether you know the claim is going to prevail. The issue is, do you know the claim is viable and it has a basis in common law and in history, and do you then just sit on it and not do anything? And that is what disturbs me about this case, is we're going to, if you ratify this kind of conduct, the state's concerned that we're going to raise the bar so high that you've got to be an Uber lawyer. I haven't seen any Uber lawyers in the 6th floor of the Milwaukee County Courthouse. I've looked.
Counsel, it's not only knowing the Constitution, it's being familiar with the common law in the history. And that's the bar you're setting for
right.
Counsel, that they would know and be expected to be...
Exactly. That's correct, Justice Wilcox, but that's where Justice Sykes' point comes in, which is this was a big change. I'm not imputing or requiring every defense lawyer to be aware of the common law on every arguable or potential criminal law matter that exists out there. But when you've got a change, when you've got the legislature taking away the jury trial right for juveniles, we got the legislature changing from 12 to 6, we got the legislature passing a law allowing for the civil commitment of certain people, those are big changes.
So your position is where you got a big change that counsel is an account and that the change is noticeable, that's your 6-12 same time jury, that's what counsel has to reason or has to know.
At least.
You're carving out something so it doesn't cover all lawyers in all cases. That's your...
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I could argue that just because something's on the internet on this court's website that some lawyer in Rhinelander has to know about it. But if something's in the Wisconsin Constitution and there's a big change, as you just alluded to, I think we're not calling for prescience. You're talking about sentience, you know, consciousness, awareness of what's going on in the world around you, in which we have all taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and defend our clients. I just don't see how this court can set a standard that says, well, it's close enough. You know, I mean, lawyers are busy, and that just troubles me. I think that this court should be troubled by that as well.
Mr. Martin, you raise in my mind a very interesting question. That is, how could the legislature take away a right of jury trial for juveniles?
Well, I didn't come prepared to discuss. I mean, it's been a long time since I read this court's decisions in those cases, and so the short answer is you can't take away a right that's in the Constitution. But if this court, and I shouldn't have alluded to something I haven't read in a while, but the legislature can't take away a constitutional right.
When I read the Constitution, I didn't see the word 12 there anywhere.
That goes back to whether Hansford is right or wrong. Six members of this court, their reading of the Constitution combined with the common law and the history said that's what a jury is, and that's what historically is understood, and at least in our Constitution, that's what it means. I mean, I acknowledge in response to your first questions, reasonable minds can differ. But at some point, we've got a binding decision from this court one way. And unless that's going to change, I think that's going to be honored. That's my point.
Thank you, Mr. Post-Weber. The court started a practice of calling lawyers who've done a good job in their